the Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Virginia.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this virtual session of the Supreme Court of Virginia. We welcome the lawyers who are arguing their cases and members of the public who may be listening on the public queue that's made available for that purpose. The clerk will call the first case.
Civia versus World Telecom Exchange Communications LLC. Melissa J. Warner, Appellant's Counsel. Virginia Whitner Hopman, James S. Kurtz, Appellee's Counsel.
All right, before you get started, the court has allotted 20 minutes per side. So let's see here, Ms. Warner, you may proceed.
May it please the court. I am Melissa Warner and I represent the appellant Yaqub Sidya in this third appeal following a 2015 trial and two remands. With the court's permission, I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
6 years after a $4.9 million verdict for two plaintiffs, Mr. Sidya has a $6 million verdict against him alone. At trial, the two plaintiffs were TuliNet FZ, LLC, and World Telecom Exchange Communications, LLC, which I will refer to as WTXC. TuliNet was dismissed in the first appeal, where the court found that it not only should have been unable to sue Mr. Sidya, but should never have been allowed to get a judgment against him because TuliNet is a foreign limited liability company that was never registered to do business in Virginia. The importance of the improper presence of TuliNet in this case cannot be underestimated. In its remand order in the first appeal, the court noted that the plaintiff's counsel, and I'm quoting here, referred to WTXC in Virginia as a service agent for TuliNet, and that WTXC's own corporate information documents stated that WTXC served merely as a technical arm of the company for fiscal reasons, so as to ensure that the majority of profits are realized in Dubai. The second remand order sent the case back to the trial court with instructions to address unresolved issues, including Mr. Sidya's sufficiency argument, and to hold a hearing to determine what portion of the damages should be allocated to the one remaining plaintiff. The first issue I'd like to address is sufficiency of the evidence. It is conclusively apparent that the verdict for WTXC is without evidence to support it. The evidence taken in the light most favorable to WTXC was not sufficient to support the jury verdict in favor of them. The court's instruction on remand to turn back the clock to the date of the verdict came with the critical change that one of the two plaintiffs that appear on the verdict form, TuliNet, was no longer in the case. The remand was thus the first time the trial court was viewing the sufficiency of the evidence solely as to WTXC. Although Judge White tracked the standard of review when stating his decision, he did not identify even one piece of evidence that he believed supported a verdict for WTXC alone. He did not state how or even if he separated evidence for TuliNet from evidence for WTXC. All three claims for which the jury found Mr. Sidya liable required proof that some wrongdoing by Mr. Sidya approximately caused WTXC's alleged injury and damages.
Ms. Warner, this is Justice Kelsey. If I may interrupt you with a question, is my recollection right that in the 2015 trial, the joint plaintiff's damages expert did an allocation of sorts of damages and allocated 95% to the parent company, TuliNet, and 5% to the subsidiary?
Your recollection is correct, Your Honor. In response to a question, the plaintiff's joint damages expert stated that 95% of the damages, the vast majority of the damages, were incurred by TuliNet.
Well, after we remanded the case to the trial court, was that 95-5 ratio brought to the attention of the trial judge?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
And how did the court respond to that?
The damages. The court responded by one being, I believe, perplexed by the state of the record in the case in determining what the task before the court was. The court did not specifically state that it was finding that only 5% were allocated to WTXE and the 95% to TuliNet. But what the court did do was not even consider the amount of the verdict itself in determining how to allocate it, but used a completely different method of deciding how much damages to award to WTXC.
So the income-based method, that was the predicate analysis for the expert at the 2015 trial, was not the basis of the ultimate decision by the court in this most recent matter.
That is correct, Your Honor. What the court did on remand was to use, instead of using that figure, they used a 2011 offer to purchase the two companies together for $1.8 million and then determined what portion of that to give to WTXC. The flaw in doing so is there are many flaws in doing so. One is that was an offer to purchase the combined companies so that WTXC never could have recovered the entire amount of money on its own. It would have shared it with TuliNet. This figure of the offer to purchase, which was never consummated, and as to which there was no evidence in the record as to the basis for that offer.
Sorry to interrupt you again, Ms. Warner. The 1.8 million offer that was used as the predicate for the most recent number, did the joint plaintiff's damages expert during the 2015 trial assert, advocate, or mention that as a basis for calculating damages in the trial before the jury?
The figure was mentioned in the trial before the jury, but it was not utilized by the damages expert in calculating the damages.
So make sure I understand that and I'm not overstating it. So the damage expert's expert report, as well as the opinion by the plaintiff's joint expert at the trial, did not advocate for the purchase price allocation method or put on evidence in favor of it that was utilized in this most recent remand.
That's correct. That is correct. Returning to the issue of sufficiency of the evidence, the trial court erred in multiple ways in finding that the evidence was sufficient to support the verdict for Mr. Sidya. There were three claims upon which TuliNet and WTXC were jointly seeking to recover. As to one of them, the trade secrets claim, the evidence there was insufficient because, first, even if there were a trade secret, the information was belonged to TuliNet. TuliNet is the one that had customers here. WTXC, as the technical arm, managed those customers, talked to those customers, dealt with those customers, but they were not its customers. Further, the information that was stored on an OrcaWave database regarding those customers was not secret. The evidence in the record is that the parties, the companies that utilized WTXC and other telephony services, shared what they were being charged because they were always trying to get a better deal from another provider. The customer list also was not secret. Further, there is no evidence that Mr. Sidya himself did anything to divulge a trade secret of TuliNet or WTXC.
I apologize to throw you off your narrative, but can you go briefly to the post-judgment interest issue, which is a matter that, if the court were to rule upon it, would affect all the cases filed in this Commonwealth? how do we define principal sum from RGR, and why wouldn't that definition apply to things like treble damages when treble damages are allowed? Without conceding anything for the purpose of the question, we don't have a lot of law on this subject, and we don't want the tail wagging the dog. So why wouldn't pretty much everything in a verdict, with the exception of purely ancillary matters, fit within the definition of principal sum?
My reading of RGR, Your Honor, is that because the case referred to the damages that compensate a plaintiff for actual harm sustained, that would preclude punitive damages, would exclude attorney's fees, because those do not compensate the plaintiff for the actual harm sustained. I believe that Virginia law is clear that it is compensatory damages that make the plaintiff whole due to the actual damages suffered. So I believe that's the line that can be drawn from RGR.
Now, you didn't have a whole lot of time, given the number of issues in the case, to develop that, but in your research, did you find that that is the consensus view of courts around the nation? Because it's obviously a very routine issue that's going to come up.
The case law that I found was consistent with that. I did not find much of it, and I regret that I do not have specific cases to cite to the court right now. I'd be happy to provide those to the court later, if so desired and requested by the court.
Yeah.
It is indeed.
That's fine. Please move on.
Okay. Thank you. I'd like to turn now to the other issue of first impression in this case, which is the question of, pardon me, I did get thrown off track, and my apologies to the court. The trebling of damages issue here, which is another issue of statutory impression. And the question being, is trebling of damages under section 18.2500 discretionary or mandatory? Here, however, there is a narrower way that the court can rule on that issue, which is that there's no amount here to be trebled because there was no express finding of the damages for business conspiracy. I found no precedent in the Commonwealth for awarding treble damages under the business conspiracy statute absent a finding of the amount of the damages for the conspiracy claim. Case law is directly to the contrary. The four relevant cases are cited on our brief at page 39. They include Tazewell Oil, in which the jury specifically awarded damages for each claim, and the conspiracy claim damages were trebled. 21st Century Systems, also the jury specified on the verdict form the damages awarded for each claim. Syed versus ZT Techs, again, the verdict asked the jury to determine the actual numerical amount of the plaintiff's damages for each cause of action. And then finally, Marina Shores, in which the jury made findings based on each individual claim.
Ms. Warner, this is Jessica Kelsey again. With yes, a general yes. verdict, and the jury speaking with one voice with a general verdict form, and there are multiple causes of action, would not the natural inference be that the compensatory damages that is identified can be justified in full by any one of the alternative legal causes of action that were proved?
I do not think so, Your Honor. I did not find authority for that proposition, where there are multiple claims and there are certain claims under which certain things can happen, where there is, for example, the business conspiracy claim, which can have trebling. Also, as to the attorney's fees issues, it also is important to determine which claims there were. I don't believe the inference can be made that the entire amount of damages can be attributed individually to each of the claims for which the jury found for the plaintiffs. Should the court reach the larger issue of the statutory interpretation, Even if there were an amount to treble here, trebling is discretionary. The two code sections, 18.2-499 and 18.2-500, together make it a crime and a tort to conspire to injure another in their reputation, trade, business, or profession. The plain language of 18.2-500 supports trebling being discretionary. It provides in pertinent part that any person who shall be injured by reason of a violation of 18.2-499 may sue therefore and recover threefold the damages by him sustained. The court has considered this issue in Advanced Marine Enterprises, in which a chancellor sitting in equity had awarded treble damages, and that was challenged on appeal. The court held that the chancellor could apply those remedies and acted within his discretion in doing so. The court then further observed that the language of the statute explicitly allows an award of treble damages on proof of the cause of action under Code Section 18.2-499.
Ms. Warner, you're down below the 5 minutes you wanted to preserve.
I would like to pause at this point then and save that time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
4:37.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning. My name is Virginia Hopman, and I am here representing the Appley WTXC, which is a Virginia LLC that before the destruction of its worldwide telephony business had its principal place of business in Fairfax County. The primary arguments that Cydia raises for reversing both the circuit court's allocation decision as well as its sufficiency of evidence ruling is that the circuit court identified no trial evidence on damages suffered by WTXC alone, and it identified no trial evidence offered on behalf of WTXC alone to support the verdict. These arguments were raised and rejected by this court on the second appeal, where Cydia argued that the dismissal of TuliNet after the first appeal required the dismissal of not only TuliNet, but also WTXC because, and I'm quoting from page 11 of the Appley brief by Cydia, quote, no evidence was presented at trial of damages suffered by WTXC alone. That court rejected this argument by Cydia in the second appeal and remanded to the circuit court with instructions to determine what portion of the damages that were awarded to both plaintiffs should be allocated to WTXC.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey again. The 1.8 million number that was used, the sale number offer that Cydia offered, wasn't that for both the parent and the subsidiary companies together as opposed to an offer to purchase merely the subsidiary?
That was the argument that Cydia made below, which was rejected by the trial court. And that was, even though nominally it appeared to be for both companies, we presented trial evidence that, I'm trying to look here to see if I can find it. If you look at, I'll court in a minute. But basically, we presented trial evidence that the 1.8 million was in reality for WTXC, its employees, and its operating assets alone. And the trial evidence that we presented included both the fact that Cydia had already incorporated a mirror company to TuliNet. They had already incorporated SBCFC in Dubai. That corporation,
the assets that were monetized in the offer were not assets 100%. You're saying the assets were 100% the assets of the subsidiary?
Yes. The assets in question, the operating assets, I'm kind of getting in front of myself here a little bit with the allocation decision, but the assets that they wanted were the WTC employees, all the employees that worked in the telephony business, except for one half time of one employee employed by TuliNet, were all WTXC employees. They had all the relationships with the customers and the clients. They negotiated all of those terms. There was evidence at trial, and we presented to Judge White below, that the OrcaWave database belonged to WTXC. The president of OrcaWave testified that WTXC, not TuliNet, was its customer. It had a contract with WTXC and not TuliNet. The WTXC employees populated that entire database, and that it never dealt with TuliNet. And so it was really that holy grail of the business, which, contrary to Cydia's argument, did not include public. It included some information that could have been obtained, such as a price paid by a particular client, but it also included all the cost data and all the margins. None of that was public. There was no way that, and there was trial testimony to that effect by WTXC, that there was no way WTXC would have provided that kind of data to the public. And that was the value in the OrcaWave database. And the OrcaWave database was owned and maintained and populated by WTXC and its employees. Sorry, the other main asset, Your Honor, was...
If my recollection is Hoffman incorrect, that during the 2015 trial, the joint expert for both the parent and the sub either said or strongly implied that the damage figure that they were seeking was 95% attributable to the damages to the parent.
That recollection, excuse me, Your Honor, that recollection is not correct. You are recalling the fact that Cydia has made that argument since 2015. But if you look at the actual testimony of that expert in question, and it is in volume one of the consolidated appendix at page 415. And the question was how much of the revenues came through TuliNet. And the revenues themselves, he said 95%. That was not the value of the company. That was the way they structured, just like Cydia and SBCFZ had structured their company, so that the parent in the tax-free zone, they structured their relationship so that as much of the income as was legally permissible was realized in the tax-free zone. That was the purpose of having the parent with that company. He did not say that 95% of the value was in the company. And while we're on this topic, I also want to address the argument made by Cydia that there was a new method used at the trial court. That is not true. The expert at trial established the value of the business that was destroyed. And the value of the business that was destroyed was $3.15 million. We deducted from that the residual assets that were left, and the jury awarded $2.68 million. No one questioned that as the value of the business destroyed. What happened below was that we presented evidence, WTXC presented evidence of the relative, value that each of the two companies contributed to and held in the worldwide telephony business. And that was all based on trial evidence. If you look at the slide that we have on page, I think it's on page 13 of our brief, you can see that the citations there are to trial testimony and to trial exhibits that show 92% of the employees, and that is all the employees other than a half-time employee that was employed by TuliNet, that worked on, developed, and maintained that business for WTXC employees. That 100% of the OrcaWave database was WTXC. The contract, the development, everything else that was populated in that database all came from WTXC. And the telecom switch, which is the third main operating asset that was needed to run this business, was owned and maintained by WTXC in New York. We went ahead and attributed, I think, 40% of the value of that switch to TuliNet, because we recognized that TuliNet had advanced the money to purchase that switch, and 40% of the amount advanced was still owed to TuliNet. All of that evidence came from the trial testimony and exhibits presented at trial. On the 1.8 million, the expert was not looking at how to allocate between the two companies. He was looking at the value of the business itself. The business was destroyed, and so that was going to be the basis for the damages. And so he did not look at the 1.8 million in terms of whether the offer was for one company or for both companies. It's after the fact, after TuliNet was gone, that this court instructed the circuit court to make that allocation. And while we don't agree, I mean, the circuit court ended up allocating about 50% to WTXC. And our position initially was that it should be 100% WTXC, because WTXC was the business. They developed the business. They
suppose the shoe were on the other foot, and the litigation strategy screwed up, which plaintiff got kicked out. And suppose hypothetically the sub got kicked out, and the parent was the only remaining defendant that could be challenged. Would you put the same valuation on the parent?
Well, I think in terms of, if we're looking at how much each company actually contributed to the development and the running of the business in question, then yeah, I think there's no question. You have to. WTXC was the operating company. And indeed, Your Honor, the first time this case was filed, the first case that was filed, it was only WTXC as a plaintiff. It was after that was non-suited in the second round, the parent was also added. And the parent did contribute something. So in light of the wording of the court's instructions, and the fact that frankly, we were hoping not to have a third remand of this case, we requested to the trial judge below that if he agreed that 100% of the value should be allocated to the company, to the operating company, to the company that actually developed and ran the business, we requested that he also allocate a portion to each based on the arguments we were making because of the way the wording was, and because we recognized that even though TuliNet didn't operate the company, it did provide some benefits. It did provide some financing, and it did in fact provide the tax-free benefits. TuliNet tried to argue, Cydia tried to argue below and also on the appeal, that because of the way they structured the income stream in order to take the most advantage they could legally take advantage of, the tax-free benefits, that should determine where the value is. And in fact, that's not true, because the proportion of the value, if you took WTXC out of the picture and you only had TuliNet, there wouldn't be that value on the worldwide telephony business, because TuliNet had one half-time employee that basically took care of the financing that TuliNet provided to them. And so going back to the $1.8 million question, we did present trial evidence that in fact, even though nominally it was for both parties, there was trial testimony that we quoted and that is found in one of the exhibits in our brief that said the only aspect of TuliNet that Cydia and SBCFZ were interested in was that TuliNet leave in place for 3 months its financing. Everything else they were purchasing was WTXC. It was the WTXC employees, it was the WTXC operating assets. It was not the half-time employee at TuliNet, or even the letters of credit beyond the first 3 month period. And so the trial judge considered and rejected the argument that Cydia is now making, that 1.8 million was for both companies in fact, and therefore could not be used. And he did not abuse his discretion in doing so. The standard here for the allocation which this court committed to the trial court to make, is abuse of discretion. The argument that he failed to follow the mandate simply has no basis below. Chief Judge White very meticulously followed the mandate and in fact began after the first time we met after the mandate came down, basically began by saying, I'm going to take each of these instructions in turn. That's how I want you to brief them. That's how we want to consider the evidence in the hearings. So Stulianet disagrees. Cydia disagrees with the allocation, but does not mean that the mandate was not followed. Unless you have any more questions on the allocation issue, I'd like to move on to the. I did have one more thing on the allocation issue. Cydia argues that the trial judge made a new determination or a new valuation of the company based on a different method. And again, both what we presented below and what the trial judge did in terms of looking at the 1.8 million was we looked for markers based on the trial evidence that would allow some kind of allocation. And because the judge believed our argument that the trial evidence showed the 1.8 million in fact represented a marker, we called it a very low ball marker. I think there was trial testimony that said it was less than half the value of the company. But he did consider a marker that allowed him to provide a basis for his allocation. And while we disagree with this, we do think there was some trial evidence to support it. And we do not believe the decision on his part to go with 50% was an abuse of that discretion. The city has spent a fair amount of time on the sufficiency of the evidence argument. And I would just like to touch a few of the high points on that. What Cydia has done here in this court, as well as below, is Cydia keeps pointing to the evidence that favors the arguments that Cydia made and at the jury trial level, that he should not be held liable because he did not engage in this conduct. Cydia ignores the evidence that the jury actually believed in finding against Cydia that was presented at trial. And if you look at slide 1.5 on page 13 of our brief, it divides the conspiracy into three different phases. And there was trial evidence that Cydia participated in each of these phases. The first phase involved what we call the conspiracy blueprint, which was basically the misappropriation of confidential financial and operations data by Cydia, Pinho, and Barmawi. And Cydia was using that information to present to banks to try to get the banks, the new company he wanted to create after they took WTXC's business. Cydia argued below, and there was testimony below that indicated that this was not confidential and it was not WTXC's data, but there was conflicting information which the jury believed that this data was precisely the same data that Penho, who was the CFO of WTXC at the time, had used and presented. There were two different slides, there were two different exhibits. The only thing that had changed was the name at the top had changed from WTXC to Cydia's company, SBC. So the jury believed that evidence and believed that Cydia had engaged in that conduct. The second phase was intentional interference with business expectancy, which we've labeled the Mauritania deceit. And Cydia and Barmawi were the only two actors on that, and they intentionally misrepresented the consequences and requirements of a new Mauritania tax. The trial evidence that supports the fact that Cydia participated in this actively are summarized on slides 9, 19, and 117 in the joint appendix at 276 and 285, And they're also summarized in our brief on pages 14 to 16 and notes 55 to 69. There is evidence of that participation. The same is true with respect to the electronic espionage, where Cydia and his co-conspirators made over 830 confirmed unlawful accesses to the OrcaWave database. There was testimony that indicated these were trade secrets. There was testimony that indicated it was WTXC that owned and maintained and had the relationship with OrcaWave and populated that database. There was testimony that this was secret information, that it included costs and margins that were not public. This trial evidence is summarized on page 16 to 18 and notes 70 to 80 of the Appellee brief. There was evidence that Cydia and expert testimony that told the jury that the expert, the forensic expert, believed that there was evidence to support the fact that Cydia himself had accessed the database. Cydia argued that evidence should not reach that conclusion, but the jury obviously rejected that argument. The same is true, and I'm running out of time. The same is true with respect to the award of attorney's fees. Both Cydia and WTXC committed the determination of the attorney's fees to the jury. They presented in the same way with client testimony, no expert testimony, and no billing records. And under those circumstances, when it's committed to the jury's discretion, it should not be overturned unless it was influenced by some kind of improper means. I see I'm running out of time, but the final argument I have is that the...
Ms. Hopson, you are out of time.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going forward. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Ms. Warner, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have two points I'd like to make on rebuttal. The first is addressing the questions from Justice Kelsey regarding the $1.8 million offer. And my opposing counsel said something in argument, which was that their expert was not looking at how to allocate damages between these two parties, that this is an after-the-fact determination. And that is a succinct statement of the problem with the case now, which is that Toolynet, who never should have been in the case, never should have sued, never should have gotten a judgment against Mr. Cydia, was in the case, and they made no effort to separate Toolynet from WTXC at trial. In fact, trial counsel directed their witnesses to use only one term for both of those parties at trial. So in the record, when they say WTXC did thus and so, I found thus and so for WTXC, they are consistently speaking of the two parties together. On remand, when Judge White was attempting to follow the court's mandate, he did not do so. He did not take the verdict that was before him and decide what, if any, portion of that was attributable to WTXC instead of Toolynet. What Judge White did was to take that figure for both companies made on a bid, only a bid, by Mr. Cydia and Mr. Barmawi for the company, a bid that was never executed, and a bid as to which there is not vast evidence in the record as to the basis for it. What were they offering? It was something that was tried in 2011, fell through, and that was that. Counsel at the remand hearing, counsel for WTXC, said there is some issue as to exactly what they bid and what they received. Nothing was received because there was no sale. Judge White, in his deliberations, took a figure that, as he said, it's a number that does show some different relationship to some extent between the two companies, I guess. But the figure that he used would never have gone to WTXC alone. It would have gone to both of them. When Judge White took the $1.8 million, deducted the value of the switch, and awarded WTXC $1.3 million, he concluded by saying, "And that's the best I can come up with on this record." The starting point for WTXC's loss cannot be all of what it and TuleNet would have received, especially when the court has stated that and recognized that WTXC was simply the technical arm of the company. I'd also like to point the court to the complaint that was filed by WTXC with regard to the ownership of the OrcaWave database. WTXC itself alleged in its complaint that the two companies together, TuleNet and WTXC, established an account with OrcaWave. That's in paragraph 30 of the complaint, and it's in the Consolidated Appendix, Volume 1, at pages 9 to 10. If there are no further questions from the court, I will rest on the brief for the attorney's fees issue, which I unfortunately did not get time to address, and this will conclude appellant's argument.
Thank you very much. The clerk will call the next case.